There have been many times when people ask me what I do, and I have to tell them that I'm simply a counselor. And for lots of years, and even now sometimes, I'd like to be able to say I'm a psychologist, or my name is Dr. Barber. But that's not true. The reality is I'm a person just like them, who because I'm like them, can help them. Not because I'm different, or separate, or better than.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband, Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
There are a lot of Christians out there who are very skeptical about counseling. And I would say as a counselor, that they really should be, and I'd like to enumerate some of those reasons, some of those concerns that I have about counseling. Jack, you have had those concerns. I know we've talked about that in the past, even towards me, because you've seen the word counseling or the word psychology, and I think you have an immediate reaction to that before you kind of figured out who I am. Now I think we're rather comfortable with each other and in our views and see each other as being very helpful to the people we're working with. But it hasn't always been so. And in fact, in our conversation in between shows here, we were talking to Tucker, the man who records for us, and he was saying how he came from a Christian background who really saw Christianity or saw counseling as something to kind of be concerned about. Had a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, and I think he really speaks for a lot of people in that community also.
Yeah, maybe I should preface this whole thing, my comments, or the way I would address it, preface it with something that may seem a little bit tangential, but it kind of frames my whole perspective on this, and that is, I never would want to be seen as, or let me put it this way, it is not my ultimate belief that I need to or should defend a certain profession or a certain vocation or a certain identity that people have. My own perspective is that, as much as I fail at this at times, my own perspective is that I as a person shouldn't identify myself as by my vocation or my profession or take the fact that my training is in philosophy, for example, and identify myself so strongly with that I just feel the need to be a philosopher and therefore defend philosophy and defend philosophers. I mean, if you step back, philosophy is met with the same kind of skepticism and prejudice that counseling is in most Christian cultures. I remember when I was going to school and I mentioned that I was thinking about studying philosophy, the most common response was, oh, you better be careful. You really don't want to do that, do you? You'll probably lose your faith. Well, having gone through it, I have to say that was a fair warning. I mean, a lot of people did lose their faith who were my colleagues who were studying philosophy with me. And I understand now why, and I understand the forces that were at work on them and so on. But where I'm going with all this is, it would be really absurd for me to try to defend the value of philosophy, because there's so much garbage, so much rebellion, so much sin, so much evil, so much unbelief that has manifested itself over the centuries in philosophers, through their writings, through their thinking, through their lives. So to defend philosophy would be ridiculous in that regard. I think the same thing could be said about counseling and psychology. Psychology has been an incredible institution where the evil of mankind, the rebellion of mankind, the unbelief of mankind, the stupidity of mankind, the foolishness of mankind, the arrogance of mankind has manifested itself in one way or the other. And you could say the same thing for any number of other disciplines. Just everything mankind has touched has turned to dust, has turned to to evil at the hands of human beings. So it's really difficult to defend any of those institutions as institutions, and nor would I want to or have any desire to do that. We just, at Gutenberg College, we just had a weekend kind of seminar where the topic was who killed Socrates, and we went back and read a couple of dialogue, Platonic dialogues, where Socrates is the main character, and discussed those and tried to give people a feel for what we do at Gutenberg College. And that one of the things that's very interesting in dealing with Socrates is that on the one hand, Socrates is condemned by and ultimately executed by Athens because he was a sophist. On the other hand, Socrates spent most of his life ministry, if you want to call it a ministry, attacking the pretensions of the sophists. That's kind of the position that you find yourself in. It's sort of the position that I find myself in. On the one hand, people might think of me as a philosopher. On the other hand, my whole life is spent opposing what philosophers have done and who they are and all of the pretensions of the philosophers. And I would think and I would trust that your whole life is spent trying to oppose what every other counselor on the face of the earth is trying to do.
Really, you're exaggerating. Don't say it that way, Jack.
But you really stand alone and apart, I should think, in the counseling community in terms of what you think is important, what you think needs to be accomplished, what you think needs to be done, what your ultimate goal in their lives is, for example.
I don't stand alone in the sense that I'm arrogant enough to think other people haven't done or aren't doing what I'm doing, because I think that even though people sometimes aren't able to articulate it, sometimes people are just drawn to the truth and drawn to goodness and drawn to wanting to be honest with themselves, and they stumble upon really good and right and helpful things. And we just might have different vocabulary, but I certainly think there's a lot of people out there who gravitate toward doing really good things, as I think probably is true in the field of philosophy. There's people who are really going off the deep end, but there's other people who have just, even through looking at the unrighteousness of man, are able to see, wait a minute, here's some truth here.
Okay. But, and maybe being inside, it makes it more difficult, but as an outsider to the field of psychology and counseling, it looks to a person like me like there's a kind of mainstream, like there's a kind of primary fundamental direction that psychology and counseling is taking in American culture today. And you and however many other people like you there are out there seem to me to not fit with that. They seem to be on the outside of that mainstream.
And what's the mainstream that you see?
That the goal of the counselor is to make people happy, to make them accepting of their lives so that they can be happy, yea, even proud of and glory in their lives, so that their problems will dissolve or at least be reduced down to manageable size. There's no moral component to the project that they're taking on. It's not a question of learning wisdom. It's not a question of learning to discern good from evil, truth from error. There is no such thing really ultimately between good and evil and truth and error. It's not a question of doing the right thing. It's a question of being comfortable with what it is that you choose to do. It's therefore a very ultimately secular perspective, riddled with relativism, cultural relativism, if not even subjectivism, that what's my truth is my truth and never mind anybody else. God is not really in the picture in any relevant way unless I choose to make, as the counselee, choose to make God part of the equation. That's the portrait of the counselor and the psychological community that I think just is writ in large in our culture, and it just seems to me inescapable.
Yeah, I think that's a good definition. I would add a little bit more to that I think is is pretty mainstream, and that's also that I don't really look at the issues in someone's life on the big screen, but I just try and change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where secular counseling is going. If you're having a problem with weight loss, then what you need to do is some behavioral objectives to take care of that, rather than look at the heart of the person who's smoking. So we're not looking at helping people in the mainstream, looking at helping people become wiser, richer internally, learn how to love, learn, understand what forgiveness is, understand the truth about themselves, the world, God. That's not at all what's going on. It's change behavior so that I feel better, or change my perspective on my behavior so that I don't have to be concerned about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, I am doing something that's immoral, I can just change my perspective and not call it immoral, but see that it works within the context of what I want my life to be like, and so then it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think another piece, I was just going to add one, but I'll add two, and that's that ultimately we can be healed. We are going to get all better, and that's the goal, rather than we're going to be able to see the truth of our lives and keep working through the process of sanctification, the process of learning, of growing, of becoming the person that God wants us to be. Instead, we are a person that has goodness within, they would say, and that we just need to tap into that goodness and find it, and that it's in and through that that we're all better. And the Christian perspective, of course, is we're sinners and we need to be saved by God. And, of course, there is healing and a lot of in from the Christian perspective, but the healing is very different than I'm going to find this good nugget within and live according to that. I'm going to find, from the Christian perspective, healing through God showing me the truth of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And taking away my blinders.
And let me add a couple more pieces. There tends to be an incredibly narcissistic dimension, agenda to a lot of modern counseling that seems to come out in a lot of the pop psychology stuff.
Now, let's define narcissism for a minute. It's a perspective, kind of egocentric. It's a perspective of myself and seeing the world through my own needs, my own desires, my own wants. And that's what's important, not looking at the best interest also of other people.
Right. So that that plays into another one, and that is, I think what most people react to when they think of counseling is how lacking in common sense it is. Same objection they have to most philosophy. There's a tendency in academia to get so close to something that I grab some kind of insight that seems profound and seems novel, and I'm intelligent enough to rationalize to kind of make my insight seem like it really applies across the board, and I lose complete perspective on what I'm doing, so that, you know, any outsider, any simple, uneducated person on the outside looking on understands what I'm saying and says, you're crazy. It ain't like that. I mean, anybody knows it ain't like that. And they're right. I mean, because they have a better perspective on it. They're not so close to it that they've lost sight of the fact that it's ultimately folly, what I'm saying. It's completely foolishness.
Can you give me an example?
Well, take for example, like in the 60s and early 70s, in the movies, your stereotypical counselor is the one who would counsel the woman who's dissatisfied with her marriage. It's just far more important that you be fulfilled. So if it means dumping your husband and your children and all of your responsibilities and go off and pursue whatever your hopes and dreams are in search of fulfillment, if you find fulfillment that way, then hey, that's what you really need to do. Well, quite apart from a biblical perspective, I mean, just leave that out of the equation for a second. Most of mankind, for most of history, has a long tradition based on things that we as human beings have learned, and that is that the stability of family and commitments and responsibilities and duty is self-protective. That there's something really valuable about finding my place, knowing my place, and living in my place. So however much somebody can make narcissistic, subjective, individualistic pursuit of self-discovery to be the end-all and be-all of life, however much they might be able to use their intelligence to make that sound noble and right and profound and good, all of human history has judged that to be folly, not wisdom, to be self-destructive and futile and empty, not fulfilling and satisfying. So, you know, your basic blue-collar worker hears that that's what the counseling community is saying and goes, that doesn't make any sense. Those guys have studied too long. And that's where the prejudice gets developed, is that they recognize they've lost touch with some really hardcore foundational realities here. Why should I trust them with anything?
Yeah, what you're saying is that the common, maybe even uneducated person can see through some of the ridiculous things that counseling has come up with and saying, wait a minute, that's not even, that doesn't even fit my lifestyle, so how can I trust that? It doesn't even fit what I intuitively know has got to be good. And so they'll walk away from it. You know, Jack, we've just been enumerating some of the mainstream understanding of counseling and some of the criticisms that people have been against counseling, I very much and wholeheartedly agree with. Lots of times, and especially Christians who look at it and say, wait a minute, I don't want to go there. That will be a very hurtful thing to me. One of the main criticisms they have is that will lead me away from God. And if what we've just said is the perspective of the counselor, I would stay away from that counselor because absolutely it will bring you away from God. Their worldview as a counselor is not going to be helpful to you. If it's relativistic, if it's narcissistic, if it has all the components that we've been talking about here today, it really is going to be hurtful. And I would recommend to Christians, don't go there. Don't go there. Years ago, I got a lot of surgery on my face as a result of cancer, and I went back to Chicago to a very renowned doctor and several times, and his waiting room was filled with people's faces that were a mess. And what he specialized in was fixing the surgery of other surgeons. And luckily, I had some really, or from the grace of God, I had some really good help in trying to find a physician that would correct the deformities that were created through the counseling through the cancer. But I have very often thought that that's a lot of the work that I do. People who have gone to secular counselors who have this mainstream view, which is really very much taught through the schools, and then they come out and they're just bleeding and dying from what they have learned. And so it seems like I am doing corrective surgery a lot of the time in my work. I think at this point maybe someone would say, well, how do I find a counselor that can be helpful to me? And what I say to people a lot is, it would be very good for you to identify exactly what is valuable about counseling, and we need to talk about what the good things are and what people should look for. But to always be eager to interview the counselor, to spend some time talking to them on the phone or asking for an informational session where they can have the opportunity to talk to the counselor and have the counselor explain what their perspective is and how they work and where they want to go, so that the person doesn't just go into it blindly, but they're taking responsibility for finding out, understanding what's going on in that counseling room or what will go on. And I really think the consumer has a huge responsibility to do that, and the counselor has a huge responsibility to talk about how they work. In fact, in the state of Oregon, where I practice, we have to give a disclosure statement. And I ask people to come in and ask me questions so that they know what they're going to be getting. I just don't think people should go into counseling without that.
Oftentimes you hear about, in fact, there is a whole body of literature, I think, for a while there, I don't know if there is right now, about integrating counseling and biblical Christianity, or integrating faith and Christianity, faith and counseling. And it really, it's always struck me as really an unfortunate, certainly an unfortunate way of putting it, if not even a fallacious way of thinking about it. Because whatever it is that I'm doing as a counselor, it seems to me, needs to flow organically out of my worldview that's a biblical worldview, out of common sense, out of the values that are biblical values, the purposes that are God's purposes as revealed in the Bible, and so on. It's not a question of taking something else and integrating it with what the Bible teaches me, but rather having my counseling be that which organically and naturally and automatically results from understanding and grasping what the biblical worldview, what the biblical value system is, and so on, and just applying that to helping someone come to understand and have perspective on the problems, the specific problems of their lives that they're wishing to address. And as you pointed out in other programs, recognizing, even leading them to see that perhaps there are more important problems to address than the problems that they're coming to address.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's often what the biblical perspective would lead us to do. Unfortunately, I think there are a lot of Christian counselors out there who literally have integrated secular counseling, counseling that is rooted in a secular worldview with techniques that make sense given that worldview, but don't make sense given another worldview, purposes, goals, agendas that make sense in a secular worldview, but don't make sense in a biblical worldview. But they keep all that, and then they are seeking to somehow baptize that with Christian concepts, ideas, vocabulary, language, and so on, and they call that integration.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that certainly is not getting us anywhere. That's not at all profitable. We need to make a radical shift, dump the secular worldview altogether, abandon it. It's no good. It's wrong. It's false. It's misleading. Just abandon it and immerse ourselves in a biblical worldview and biblical truths and biblical values, and allow whatever we do, however we conduct ourselves as counselors, in the light of what makes sense given that worldview.
Okay, I really very much agree with you on one hand, but I want to clarify something, and I don't think it's a disagreement, I don't think, but I think it's certainly a clarification.
Okay.
I very much wholeheartedly agree with you about this organic approach to counseling. And I think what you mean by that is I need to immerse myself in an understanding of the Scripture, an understanding of how God sees the world and how He sees me, how He sees people. To understand that, to live that out in my relationships, to work at not being blind toward myself or other people, to really work out my salvation with fear and trembling, just to the best that I can. So I'm becoming a wiser person, a more loving person, a more giving person, a person that is very much dedicated to obeying and understanding who God is. And it's out of that I do my counseling. I agree with you so wholeheartedly there, Jack, that I can hardly tell you how much, how important that is to me and how radical I think that is. Several years ago, though, I was concerned that I think unwisely concerned that I had gotten too far away from the psychological understandings that I had been raised with in my education 25 years ago or so, and really felt like I didn't have I wasn't really on the cutting edge. So I went to I went and looked for a person that could help me develop this. I found a person who, so I'm going to be a little vague because I don't want to identify her exactly, but she was very much a leader in the field. She had great recommendations from very many people. She is a professor. She has a private practice. She has some age on her. And I thought, certainly this person is going to kind of whip me into place and help me kind of gain back some of this cutting edge stuff that I hadn't kept up with well. I walked into her office and we talked for half an hour, and I said, you know, What I really want to do is I want to go back and get a PhD because I think that I'm just kind of slacking off here. She stopped and she looked at me and she said, it was wonderful. She said, Christine, if you did that, you would ruin yourself. You would ruin what you have as a counselor. Don't do it. She's a person that teaches. She's a person, in fact, that teaches in a PhD program. And I was just stunned. But that was really what I needed. I just am so grateful for her insight. She saw that what I had was what I needed as a counselor. And I needed to not go and try and go toward the secular route of trying to understand more of what they were trying to teach. But somehow she saw that I already had the heart and the spirit that was needed to give to these people. And I have been so grateful for that, because it really gave me this second boost of energy that I needed, to kind of this endorsement that said, go for it, Christine. You're going in a good direction. And I know that because I see a lot of change in people's life that's positive. I see people headed toward the values that God holds, and I see them headed toward God. In fact, very much I see myself as an evangelist in my job. And that's what I want more than anything. I want people to understand and know and pursue God. And that's not what they'll hear me say, but that's in and through all that I do, they end up going in that direction. Not that I push them in that direction, but I don't come from a worldview, for example, that I had this I don't have a relativistic viewpoint, for example, that says, you know, you just feel good about whatever you're doing, and whatever you're doing is okay. I help people look at the consequences of their actions. For example, if they're having an adulterous affair, well, let's look at the positive, let's look at the negative, let's look at the consequences in your children's lives, let's look at your mental status as a result of this. Let's look at how it impacts other parts of your life. And so people are given the opportunity to look and see what's going on in their lives without me telling them which direction to go in. But I open up and help them look at things that they normally wouldn't want to look at. That's not what a secular counselor would do. They would endorse what the other person is doing, I think, a lot of times out of fear of being rejected themselves. But I think that's another discussion. But yes, on one hand, I really do agree with what you're saying. On the other hand, there is a lot of human wisdom that's been gained by all people over the ages, not just Christians. All people have the opportunity to experience life. And I think it's probably true in psychology as well as it is in counseling, that people's experiences and their common sense will give them an understanding that really does lend a lot of information to both the secular and to the Christian community. They may not be believers, but they see some things accurately, and it's important to take that into account and to use that as part of what I'm seeing in life. I think there's a lot to be gained by that. Some techniques that a secular counselor would use. Some of those, they're good to have in a database for me. Not that I pull out and just use on you because I want to technique you, but because there's this database, this repertoire. It's like somebody may be playing a piece on the piano and they have just an enormous repertoire, and they may not always play Bach, but they can add Bach into it because they understand how that fits into this piece that they're trying to create, this feel, this mood that they're trying to create. And so, yeah, I do use a lot of things that are kind of the backdrop that I've learned, but they come out of an organic understanding of where I want to go in my life.
Yeah, what I would say the same thing, certainly with my training in philosophy, that there's a lot of things to be learned but from a lot of different philosophers. But as a Christian, studying them, I had to think critically about what these guys were saying. And what I mean by think critically is I needed to realize that some insights are true because it's just human rationality seeing things the way they really are. Other things are a false worldview working out its implications, and it's grounded in a false worldview rather than just God-given common sense. Well, I would expect the same thing is true in psychology. If you have a Freudian worldview, there are certain techniques that are going to make sense in the context of that worldview, but it's not that they're rooted in common sense. They're rooted in a fallacious view of the world, a fallacious view of human beings, a fallacious view of the human mind, a fallacious view of God. And out of that worldview come certain techniques that can be rationalized in the light of that worldview, but there's nothing grounded about them. They're not grounded in any truth, in any reality, or in what I'm calling common sense. Other insights, even insights by Freud, mind you, other insights are just keen observations rooted in common sense of the way people interact with one another, what's going on, how we're thinking, how we're relating to one another, and they could have come from anybody. I mean, they're just truths about the world. So to think critically is to discern, is this grounded in reality and in truth and common sense, or is this grounded in some false worldview? And to throw out the latter and to embrace and use and employ the former.
Oh, and it takes an incredible amount of work to do that. I really take my hat off to people who are trying to go through a secular counseling program, and you've really got to go through a program in order to get the license, in order to practice, unless you're a pastoral counselor or something where you don't need a license, but the state requires it. I don't know if all states require it, but I don't know any that don't. So you've got to get this piece of paper. In fact, I've recently had a couple of friends who are going through counseling programs, and they have really struggled with trying to work with and inside of their program with their very different perspectives. I think these two people happen to be pretty well respected in their programs, but I think they've really had to work hard at holding on to what they think is true and being able to have integrity with that and be able to pass the course. It's a very hard thing to do, and I have found it an incredibly big challenge to understand my faith and to keep being a counselor out of my faith rather than out of the secular community, because it's so pronounced, it's so there, and they believe that they have it, that they have a corner on the market. And I think according to their own values, they're doing a good job. It's just that I don't share those values, and I think it's hurtful to help people in the way they're helping them. I see the integrity with it. There's a consistency in it. They believe certain things, and out of those things, they are practicing. I just don't believe those things. I am practicing out of a whole different world of view.
This comes back to the place where I was starting, and I don't think I really adequately made this point, but how does one survive going through a graduate program in philosophy or a graduate program in counseling or psychology, and keep one's faith intact and have integrity with one's faith? One thing that's deadly is if it becomes important to me that I identify myself with my profession, because it's very, very difficult to identify yourself with the profession and have that not translate into having the respect and the regard for my colleagues in the profession, and to be well received within the circle, the community of the profession, which means basically that's what the Bible calls fearing man rather than God, that is lusting after the respect and the regard from my colleagues and not in any way wanting to jeopardize that or put that in jeopardy.
Because if you do, you end up not getting your license, you end up not getting your degree.
Right.
So there is a place where you have to have integrity with where you're going and yet be in a position where you're, not and yet, but also be in a position where you are respecting the people around you.
Yeah. The thing that's deadly is the intangible thing, though. It's not the not getting your license and so on. I mean, you can jump through hoops and play games, I suppose, enough to get that. But what's deadly is if I own the regard and the respect for the other people in a way that it stays with me. It's a lifelong.
Well, you have to jump through the hoops to get there.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
You absolutely do.
To even be accepted as part of the.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of hoops. But in the midst of that, I think you, in in order to maintain your integrity, either you jump through the hoops and you lose your integrity, or you jump through the hoops and your integrity is deepened. And I think that's what you're talking about here, is we can't have one or the other. I've got to jump through the hoops, and how do I maintain my integrity? That's a big, huge question, and that's what I think you're saying is very difficult.
Well, and the part of it, the piece of it that I'm concentrating on is, for me, being trained up through academia was feeling, especially early on, this lust for intellectual respectability. I mean, during the last several decades, Christians have been intellectual outcasts. You know, they're morons, they're idiots, they're, especially fundamentalist Christians, are despicable human beings. I mean, they don't have a brain in their body.
That's
the perception of the academic community. Well, a fundamentalist Christian, from their perspective, is what I am. I mean, for them, they don't have any real subtle distinctions that they work with.
You're just
anybody
a major
who takes
loser.
The Bible seriously is a fundamentalist, and fundamentalists are, of course, idiots. Well, to feel the pressure of knowing that if they really knew what you believed, they would deem you an idiot, is a tremendous amount of social pressure to put on a person. And the integrity that you're talking about, what you have to finally decide is, if they want to view me as an idiot, then I guess they will have to view me as an idiot. But this is true, and I'm not going to forsake the truth for the sake of having them think better of me. It's not really about necessarily even going public on it. It's the mm-hmm. inner thoughts. It's the secret, hidden thoughts that are the really crucial ones, the vital ones. Am I in my own head ashamed of this thing that's true? Because if I am, it's only a matter of time that I'm going to begin to wean myself of it. I'm going to throw it out, and I'm going to begin to mold myself to the worldview and the thinking of my colleagues. I'm just going to start thinking like they think, and their values are going to become my values. In order to maintain unique and distinctive values as taught to me by the Bible, I have to be proud of them, not ashamed of them. I have to really, truly, profoundly embrace them, not run from them. And I think the same thing would have to be true in a counseling curriculum or a psychology curriculum.
I don't profoundly embrace them in a rigid way, and I think that's how people can interpret that. I can't profoundly embrace them in a rigid way. And I think that's how a lot of people would maybe...
In a dogmatic, unthinking way.
Right. And I'm just gonna hold on to this, and it doesn't matter, I'm just going to hold on to this. Don't you guys criticize me. But I'm in the place of needing to be able to think through the questions that they bring to me and be open to that, so that my faith is not based on something that's fragile or rigid, but it's based on something that I'm willing to think through, that I'm willing to understand, that I'm willing to be challenged with.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that I come to really believe it, and out of that belief that's based on common sense, thinking through, time, study, experience, I have embraced it with my whole heart. And then I can approach any kind of profession and any kind of life with that firmly embedded in me. And I must say that I really don't recommend a counseling program for people who are young, because I don't think that we've come to the place where we have our beliefs firmly embedded yet. We don't have a life that's been developed yet. And to be able to hold on to my faith and to give my faith, to give my life, to give my heart, as I must do in counseling, to other people, I just don't have it developed yet. I'm too young. I started when I was, I think 20, and got my, you know, worked toward my license very early. And I just think, wow, that's way too young. That's way too young. I wouldn't recommend myself, you know, 15 years ago. There's a lot that life hadn't taught me yet. And that's another thing I would tell people if they're looking for a counselor, is look for a little bit of age at least. I don't think I'd go to anybody that was, you know, maybe under 30. And that's young. I mean, I'm 40-something, and I think that's pretty young. I think I'm going to be a better counselor when I'm 60. I hope I'm a better counselor when I'm 60.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another piece of what I'm saying is I feel the tug of this often, and I have to resist it. It's just the actual pretension itself of identifying with my profession. If I think of myself as a philosopher, then how can I do that without thinking of myself as having a certain kind of expertise and a certain kind of skill and a certain kind of experience that puts me a cut above somebody else? Now, on the one hand, of course, that's true. On the one hand, I mean, I have studied things other people haven't studied. I've exposed myself to things that other people have had no exposure to. So it's not that that's false. But there's a mindset that you get into, and that's the deadly thing. The mindset being that, well, I'm a philosopher.
I'm Dr. Crabtree.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Crabtree, yeah. That mindset is just deadly because it's just nothing but pretentious. You know, one of the things that John writes in 1 John that we need to resist because they're passing away, he says, do not love the world or the things of the world, for the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and it usually gets translated the boastful pride of life. He identifies those as the things of the world that we're not to love. Well, I think what he means by that boastful pride of life is just all that pretentiousness that we human beings bring to our various pursuits. And it can be being a plumber or being a contractor, or it can be anything, but we get so uppity and so pretentious about these ultimately transient, ephemeral, meaningless, ultimately valueless things that we do that we feel so important for having done. And that's the attitude that we need to take toward any of our professions. That, look, I'm just struggling here with everybody else to understand, and this is the avenue that I've chosen to expose myself to come to some sort of understanding. But I'm just a student in the final analysis. I'm just a bumbling human being coming to do my best to try to finally understand what this is all about. The arena in which I've chosen to do that is philosophy, but when all is said and done, I'm not a philosopher. I'm just someone who's come to realize how little I understand. But I've come to understand a few things. Well, that's not saying much, at least. And if I think that it's saying much, then there's the pretension that we need to avoid. Pastors have the same problem. I mean, when I was a pastor, it was an occupational hazard. People come to you expecting that you have an answer to their question or a solution to their problem. And there's an incredible pressure on you, therefore, to have the solution and to have the answer. It was very difficult for me as a pastor to say to someone, boy, I don't know. That's really a difficult problem. Boy, I don't have a clue. Mm-hmm. That was the truth. But your professional pride, the pretentiousness that you felt, forced you to make up a solution or to make up an answer and to bluff your way through it, to kind of BS your way through it. Why? Because, well, you couldn't be seen as not having the answer. That wouldn't be very professional. Well, the antidote to that is, well, then don't think of yourself as professional. Think of yourself as a bumbling idiot, and then you can reveal who you really are.
Okay, so you have this soapbox you've been on for a while, and I don't think I've hit it quite too directly, so I think I'm going to try and hit it real directly this time, okay?
Okay.
What you're saying, Jack, is not to be taken... The last thing you said, I think, could be taken wrongly, so I'm going to start from there. And it's not that you really think about yourself as a fool, in the sense that you don't know anything or you don't understand anything or that you're just an idiot after getting this PhD and there's nothing that you've learned. I don't think that's what you're saying at all. What you're saying is, I have learned a lot. I've given myself access to a whole lot of information, a whole lot of study, a whole lot of experience, a whole lot of thinking about an area of life that makes sense to me and that helps me understand the deeper whisperings of life. And you really value that, and you've gained from that. But even as you've gained from that, perhaps the biggest thing that you've gained is that there's this reality, there's this truth, that you're just regular old Jack still. Who cares that you have a capital DR in front of your name or a PhD? It doesn't make any difference, because although that gives you access into academia and to some teaching opportunities that are important, it doesn't change just bumbling old regular person Jack. And it is that bumbling old regular person Jack that is actually in real life meeting with other bumbling, everyday, ordinary, mundane, trying to make it work but struggling people. That's who we all are out there.
Right.
And that's what you want to communicate. And I think that's really what gives you a ministry. It's what gives a pastor a ministry, is understanding that I'm like the people that I'm working with. I can help them maybe see out of my experience. I can help them maybe come to looking at questions asking questions or looking at their questions differently. But I ultimately don't have it all. That's the same as a philosopher, and that's really the same as a counselor. Do I get it?
Yeah, and the pastor as well. I can remember I went to school as an undergraduate. I had a friend who went through the undergraduate the same time I did. And I went on into an intern program at a church, and he went on to seminary. And a summer or two later, we met up again, and we were kind of comparing notes. And the issue of preaching came up. You know, what do you do as a preacher? And he was saying that what they had taught him at seminary, and he seemed to be persuaded by it, what they had taught him at seminary is, if you're teaching a passage of the Bible and you don't know exactly what it means, teach it, pick an interpretation and teach it with authority anyway. Don't be tentative. Don't reveal the fact that you're at all shaky or tentative in your understanding. Teach it with authority, because if you don't, you're going to lose authority in the eyes of the congregation. Well, I objected to that at the time, and I object to that even more strongly today. I just think that that is so incredibly dishonest to start with. I mean, it lacks integrity to start with. And I think it's just wrong on its own terms as well. There are some people, who want a false security, and they want someone to pretend like they know what they're doing all the time. I know that there are people out there like that. But anyone who's really is seeking after truth and who has their eyes open, and anyone who can profit by your ministry, you're not going to lose authority in their eyes by saying, I don't know, to what I don't know. You're going to gain respect and authority in their eyes, because they're going to learn to trust you, that you're not going to manipulate them. You're not going to lie to them. You're going to tell it straight. And when you're tentative, you're tentative. And when you're sure, you're sure. When you're confident, you're confident. And that person is ultimately trustworthy, I think.
Yeah, they'll trust you. And I think what's even more important is they'll come to trust themselves some in their process that they need to use to
right.
look at issues themselves.
Because you're affirming their own discernment.
They can be regular human beings who have questions, who kind of blunder around, who are trying to figure it out but are having a hard time doing that. And if they see other people as not blundering, as being all together, as being top gun, then I shouldn't be blundering. I should have it all together. And that's so not true. I just can't tell you how many times I tell people that all the time. And I think that's really what people should look for in a pastor, in a counselor, and a philosopher, as we've been talking about these three, is this person willing to recognize and see their own weaknesses, to see their own self accurately, not as a step above everybody else, but just like you. And I think that's the point that you're getting at, and I think that's what makes my ministry as a counselor very valuable to myself, because I'm learning and growing. I'm on a journey just like they are. So it's a humbling journey as well as a very encouraging journey to other people. Some people don't stick with it because they want me to be a person that has all the answers. 95% do, because they recognize that there's a camaraderie between us. We are human beings struggling in life, trying to get it. And I'm just coming alongside them as a person that's trying to love them, trying to care about them, trying to help them see, as I myself am trying to see through the process.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
We've been asked to remind you that that this broadcast does cost money, and that we would be very grateful for any contribution that you can make to pay for the airtime and some of the costs for producing this program. I would like to say something, however, that from the biblical perspective, as I read the New Testament, when Paul talks about people being generous and making contributions to his ministry or other ministry, his primary concern is not the practical costs involved. His primary concern is that where people invest their money is a reflection on where their heart is. So the fact that they would value the gospel so highly that they would value the people who are proclaiming that gospel, whenever he sees people making money contributions to the progress of the gospel, he sees that as a reflection of the Spirit of God at work in their lives to give them eyes to see how truly eternally valuable that message is. That ultimately is our concern for you as well. You know, whether you give money to this program or don't give money to this program is really, in the final analysis, not all that important. But what is important, and what we do desire for you, is that you, in your own way, manifest an acknowledgement that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the most important thing in all of reality and the most important thing in your life. That this really is truly valuable. And by God's grace, God has given you eyes to see how truly valuable it is, that you're not blind to it, you're not callous to it, you're not insensitive to how precious it is, but that by God's grace your heart has been touched, and you see that the blessing that the gospel promises you is more valuable than any money can buy. That's our real desire for you. And whether it translates into a contribution to our program is not the important thing, but that you invest your whole life and all of your money in that which is truly valuable. That's what we really ultimately care about.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 1-800-327-9703. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.